So, Kirkland's signature craft beer. in all seriousness, like most, like many of us laughed when I mentioned that down at the stop. A few of you laughed again now. Why is that funny? And I'm asking that question to try to help get us at, like, what isn't perhaps so appropriately crafty about Kirkland's signature craft beer?
Kirkland.
say more about Kirkland. Like, what?
Well, you just think of mass.
Mass production. Yeah.
And with that, we think that it's going to be cheaper always, which it necessarily isn't, you know, in all cases. But, you know, we like to look down on cheap things, but most of us are also attracted to, you know, to things that don't cost as much either.
Okay. Is there a possibility that there are some things that are mass produced that are just damn good?
So,
having never had Kirkland beer, what kind of beer is it? Is it a light beer, a dark beer, a high
it's
caliber?
It's all kinds of different ones.
Right, but in the case of the beer you saw, what would you have said it was based on sight?
As I recall, there were like three or four different things in that large box together, like six bottles of each or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I don't recall any more than that. I'm sorry.
Scottish ale.
I mentioned that if it's a light beer, it would be hard to necessarily give it the craft title.
Why are light beers not crafty, but darker beers are? I'm curious to learn here.
Taste. Light beers are more bland in their taste.
Ooh, so bland versus, what's the opposite of bland here?
Complex.
Complex.
Or rich.
Rich.
Yeah. Okay.
There's no trace of the maker in the final product.
Mm-hmm. Ooh.
I like that.
Ooh. I like that. Remind me your name, please.
Michael.
Thank you, Michael. I recognize the face. I'm just like, not getting the name. All right. So, yeah, Marisa.
I mean, along the lines of what Michael had mentioned, there seems to be with a craft beer, at least when I think of it, that there's sort of a unique attention given to that particular product, the end sort of goal or product, as opposed to that more sort of mass feel where it's maybe less attention and just more for the quantity as opposed to the quality aspect.
Well, craftsman best game is emotionally based for a reason. It's personal. Where Kirkland is looking for some change, you know, they have a financial interest in marketing.
So the personalness of it for those who couldn't, the wind was taking it away. All right.
I think, if something like a piece of furniture is made by an individual craftsman and we buy it, we get the sense that, in a sense, it was made for us, even if we've never met the person who made it. But we feel some sort of a vague personal connection with the person whose hands were on this thing. Whereas if something's made on a machine, you can have no personal connection with a machine.
Right. So we've got about a half a dozen threads weaving together here in these various ways. The uniqueness, the personalhood of it, which is maybe we can think about that uniqueness as a starting point. So a uniqueness in terms of the person who made it, a uniqueness in terms of who it's for, at least in some cases, a uniqueness in terms of the complexity, the richness of its own flavor, of what it is in itself. It's not the same thing as the other 10 billion bottles of Coors Light, or whatever else, or Kirkland Light, or I don't know. So at all of those levels, there's something kind of unique or individual that language of craft suggests us toward. And so it's able to stand out. And that's maybe beginning to hook us back into excellence from another way. So put all of those as kind of some initial feeling our way into this idea of craftiness or of craft or of whatever those things might be. We might go so far as to say that in a general way, it tells a story, whether that's a story about the maker, the story about where it came from, the story about the particular ingredients that have their own kind of robust flavor to them. I think about the difference, to slightly switch examples, between a generic red wine blend and a particular varietal of wine with particular grapes in a particular year of a, that have a very unique flavor. I'm thinking about how Marisa, who was once a waitress at a wine bar, just picking up glasses of wines from all over different places, being able to tell me like where in California that wine came from or where in the world that wine came from by taste. My generic red blend is probably not going to do that.
When I think of excellence in something to me, I think that the guy making it or the girl making it is an emotional attachment.
Emotional attachment?
Yeah, I know when you know, I used to do lots of crafty things, like those architectural scale models out of
yeah.
stuff. And I put myself into them. And when I got done, I knew that they were for sale or for a gift or something, but I really, you know, I felt a sense of loss giving the thing away. There's something for me in there. And I think, you know, that personal connection, like, you know, I can imagine myself brewing beer that way. Mm-hmm. And I really want to drink it and give it to my friends, but I wouldn't feel right about, you know, putting it in Walmart or whatever. That personal connection, that extension of oneself, you know, and another version of that, you know, I've done all sorts of woodwork, and I never use power tools of any sort because I find them all grossly overpowered, and I like the idea of the amount of energy put into it directly corresponds to the amount of work you get. That, you know, that direct connection, but the energy expended in.
Nice.
And product produced, you know, that to me is it's a big part of craft. If I start just whipping things out with power tools, I lose that connection.
I've heard
what that's worth.
Yeah, I thought Amber wants to jump in, and I'll give us some vocabulary to make precise a little more of this.
I know we're talking about the reason the word craft, but I know we're talking about excellence in general. I think there are a lot of homemade things that are pretty shitty, and a lot of mass-produced things that are incredible engineering.
Yeah.
So,
good.
Yeah.
Good.
I do think that that is just because it's made with the heart. Like yeah. I made a lot of like macaroni things for my mom. And it was really shitty at the end of the day.
Yeah,
and
good.
If I throw it away, I won't be sad.
Good.
And there are some things that the excellence in science, or the excellence in engineering, which has created, yes, they might be able to mass produce things, but it's still pretty damn good.
Good. So let's see if we can tie some of this together. I think we've got maybe three or four different axes that we're working with that are all getting at a piece of what we're after, but maybe a different piece, right? So on the one hand, we have this idea of, you know, things that are commodities versus things that are not. And that there's something about commodification where, in economic speak, things are fully fungible, fully interchangeable one to another. Like, the paradigm case for this is gasoline, right? A gallon of regular unleaded, in theory at least, is the same as any other gallon of regular unleaded I put into my tank, which is why all the gas station does on their sign is just put the price. And I know that there are variations about bad refineries and what have you, but in theory, a gallon of gasoline ought to be like any other. A ton of number two commodity corn for making corn syrup ought to be just like any other ton of number two commodity corn. And so a commodity in that sense as a term of art is something that's fully fungible, fully interchangeable with other things. And so some of what we were getting after was a space for uniqueness in a thing as opposed to fungibility. And maybe in a way going beyond that, responding to the uniqueness that we find in the world in various ways. So I think about the woodworker, right? Historians of antique furniture, and there are such people in the world, they have journals and books and all these things that they write. They can take apart an old table or an old chair or an old armoire or whatever, and by examining the tool marks that the maker left behind. They can tell how he made it, what the tools were, what the steps were, you know, which things, you know, which boards came from the same log and which ones didn't. They can reconstruct the process by seeing the evidence of the process there in the finished product, in a way that something just extruded out of a machine shows a different kind of evidence of where it came from, perhaps. But things like that replicator on Star Trek that maybe we're familiar with, at least in passing, you know, where you just, you know, utter the command and a magic copy just appears in the device, loses a sense of that in a little bit. But that the craft product, the craft beer or the craft wine or the crafted wood item or whatever it is, or the crafted statue, right? There's that famous thing attributed to Michelangelo about seeing what form is already latent in a hunk of marble and kind of uncovering it or extruding it. As a woodworker, we look at the grain and the knots and the other patterns of the wood and see what these boards would like to be or what they're capable of being in a way that some other board, even of the same species, might not, because of the way in which that grew. In Wales, there's a great tradition of making like the curved backs of chairs by going out into the woods and hunting for a branch of a tree that already has the unique curve in the way that it grew. It makes an extraordinarily strong piece of furniture because it naturally wants to be that way. But then everyone is this connection with what will these branches that I find in the woods on this day allow me to make, which are not the same things as other branches in a different wood on a different day. So that kind of noting the character that's already present in a thing. Here, the philosopher of technology, Albert Borgman, over at U of M, introduces us this distinction between, he's using these terms in very specific ways. He's going to stipulate, he's not using these words necessarily in the common vernacular, just like bracket that to begin with, right? But he distinguishes between what he calls things and devices. You're familiar with this already? If you don't have been on the spot, that's fine. But.
No, we had somebody who was a student under Albert Borgman come in, and we had to read about a couple of his differentiations between things and devices, and how a thing is something that's like a stove. You have to work with it. You have a relationship to it, and a device is more of something that is like what you were saying about commodification.
Yeah. So a device, you have to work with it. It has a character or a nature of its own that presents itself to you. It's not just a channel for your own desires that you impose upon it and like wave a magic wand and it becomes whatever you want. It's something that was already there before you. Maybe not in time. Maybe the stove was just made in a factory 2 years ago or whatever. But it existed before I got to decide what it was going to be or what it was like. So natural things are like that in a very obvious way, right? You know, the dog has its own needs and desires and interests and activities before we ever adopted it or before we ever met the dog here on the trail or any dog, right? In order to see that dog, he or she?
She.
Okay. In order to see that dog as she is, right, I need to pay attention to her and let her teach me about herself. I'm also going to, if she's a puppy especially, I'm going to train her. I'm going to help shape her behavior in various ways. But that's not just me forcing her into a mold. That's me entering into a relationship with her. And so for Borgman, as I understand him, things in this sense are like that, in that they have kind of a substance of their own, whether they're a living thing or even inanimate things of various kinds. This board can only do certain things and not others. I had this piece of 40 years in a barn, air-dried cherry that I was trying to, and the way that it was dried, it was case-hardened. The outside had dried in this really brittle way. If you just tapped it the wrong way, the board would just crack. it wasn't a split. It wasn't following the grain of the wood. It would just crack because of the way it was dried. And so I had to be very careful in the way that I used that lumber, what I could ask that lumber to do, how we would work to make anything at all besides kindling for a fire. And some boards are only really good for kindling for a fire. But in that sense, they were a thing and not just a device, not just a way of me projecting myself onto the world. And so that's the distinction that Dr. Borgman gives us.
Just along those lines, I may be confusing things with this, but the way that you describe that, it almost made it sound like not the things, but the where we're identifying craftsmanship or the other, that there's a sort of, rather than an object, there's sort of a subject component. Like there's this life of its own in it. Is that?
I think that's helpful. I am not the only subject in some of these processes, right? You know, the skilled sculptor or artist or woodworker or brewer or whomever is responding to the materials that she's working with as also being subjects in their own right, as having a character in their own right of whatever kind. I think that speaks to, you know, maybe that helps us get at it in another way. So there's something about working with, in Borgman's terms, things rather than only devices that allow for that uniqueness to come forward in the interplay of all of these working together. Another axis of this is a distinction that David Pye gives us in a book called The Nature and Art of Workmanship. He doesn't like the word craftsmanship for various reasons that he explains. He likes this word workmanship. And he distinguishes between what he calls the workmanship of risk and the workmanship of certainty. Where certainty is basically, you know, pull the lever and get the same thing every time. Your Star Trek replicator is the perfect example of that. But even your, other kinds of devices are like that. Think of the milkshake machine at McDonald's. You pull the lever and you get the same generic vanilla swirly thing out in basically the same way. And whatever that might
That's
be,
excellent.
Right?
Excellent. Have you had that ice cream?
As opposed to, you know, think about do people still whip their own cream to make whipped cream,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
You've got to actually get it right. you can screw that. I mean, it's not that hard, but you can screw it up, right?
Or baking a souffle.
Oh, you can screw that up. More often than not, are you going to screw that up if you're me? So baking that souffle is not just push a button on the stove, walk away, come back in 20 minutes when the timer dings. You are not going to have a souffle when you do that. Thanks, Mike. That's an awesome example. So the souffle would take a lot of what Pye calls the workmanship of risk. So, you know, risk at the obvious level implies, like, you can screw up royally. Mm. Like, you cannot get what you're after. And Pye attributes that risk to the requirement in those processes for, in his language, skill, dexterity, and judgment on the part of the person who's doing the thing, right? So that there's a, you know, there's a being able to navigate the particular situation of this souffle with these ingredients and these weather conditions, which seem to matter far more often than you would think with that kind of cooking, and so on and so forth, right? So there, that the product, the end result is not guaranteed. And so he suggests to us that the more that we have this is not an either or. This is a spectrum of degrees or of even parts of a different process. Parts of it might have risk to a certain degree, other parts don't, right? I think about, you know, to come back to Dennis's examples, right? If I have that kind of DeWalt compound miter saw, I just set the saw, chop, chop, chop. Every cut is perfectly identical to every other. If the tool is set properly, it's even like square and right angled and all those sorts of things. as opposed to picking up a handsaw and by eye cutting a square or whatever angle I need. The one has risk involved because it requires the skill, the dexterity of the judgment of me or of Dennis or whomever as the user of that tool. Whereas the electric compound miter saw that's all jigged, I just drop it, right? That's more approaching the workmanship of certainty.
The example about the souffle, I'm sort of thinking about it.
It's great.
Sort of like the distinction between, one distinction I've heard between cooking and baking is that baking has, like, it's a whole different ball game where you have both a science, and sort of a science and an art. And so I'm wondering, just in the context of that risk-taking, the skill, the dexterity, the judgment, if within the scope of excellence, craftsmanship, workmanship, however we're defining that, if that sort of, that balance between a science and an art, if we're making those kinds of distinctions, or if those are an important component in what it means for something to be perceived as excellent or pursued in a way that's excellent for your... Not just sort of throwing something on the wall, perhaps, but there's this...
Well, this might be getting us to hook into some of the remarks that Amber was actually making earlier, where we might just want to distinguish between, in some sense, an excellent product and the excellent execution of bringing that about. So we can think about the unity or the disunity of planning and execution, right? So the person who designs the factory for mass producing a novel and innovative and wonderful item, there's a kind of room for improvisation, for experimentation, for creativity and judgment on the part of the factory designer or the person who makes the plan for the equipment, but that there's not that room for planning and judgment and responsiveness on the part of the person who operates the equipment. Somewhat famously, when Henry Ford first opened his assembly line for the Model T, every time they were hiring people who were like craftsmen in the old sense, carriage makers and wagon makers with like apprenticeships and massive sets of skills and judgments and room to work in various ways. When they wanted in those first few years to hire another 100 men for an assembly line, they'd need to make something like 900 hires because so many people would walk off the job within the first few weeks in disgust that they were not being treated like people anymore. They were accustomed to a different way of working, which was not just turn this screwdriver at the pace that the conveyor belt demands. So, you know, he solved that by paying his workers five times as much as he had originally wanted, temporarily, till he put all the small carriage makers out of business, and then went back to the other approach. But it worked for a little while.
I think to kind of connect that with what Amber said.
Yeah.
If you think about a Ferrari versus a Yugo, maybe. Even though a Ferrari, you know, they're assembled in a factory on an assembly line, but you know that far more meticulous planning and designing and thought have gone into the creation of that product than maybe a lesser quality of vehicle. So, yeah, like you said, the manufacturing process may be similar, but it's in the designing phase where there's a difference.
The product, the quality of the...
Yeah.
Sometimes features are assumed to be quality. You know, so if you had a Ferrari that was could only go about 200,000 miles and it was done, but you had a Yugo that ran for 500,000 miles before it was done, is there some level of craftsmanship or durability?
So to ask the question, what makes a good product in its own right? What are we after? Whether it's, you know, that need for speed and all that for a little while with the Ferrari, or the kind of slow and steady, but, you know, drive to the moon and back a half a dozen times on the Yugo.
And I think that's where excellence obviously comes in so many different varieties.
Good.
Like the sled dog. So, like we were kind of talking about the difference, there are sled dogs who race and like the Iditarod, and they're long distance runners and they're small and scrappy little dogs. And then there are sled dogs that haul shit and they're big and they're slow.
Yeah.
And they're both excellent.
Good.
They're just very. They have different. I guess the. Means meet different ends, and so excellent.
Yeah.
Depending on what you want your outcome to be, is going to be different.
So I think we can look at that from two directions simultaneously, and then maybe we'll get up and move in just a minute or two. But this idea of, on the one hand, what am I after? What are my ends? And so what kind of sled dog do I need to, move a whole bunch of stuff versus to win a race or to do whatever else? But I can also ask, all right, these are the dogs who I have. What is their excellence? In Aristotle's language, what is their telos? What is their end or their good? What opportunities could I create for this dog to be excellent? Mm-hmm. There are certain dogs that are just never going to be race-winning sled dogs. There are certain dogs that are never going to be successful, happy, pull-a-bunch-of-stuff dogs. There are certain dogs that are never going to be excellent guard dogs or herding dogs or whatever else, right? The excellence of, on the one hand, if I don't have a dog yet and I want one, what kind of dog do I need for my work? But on the other hand, here is my dog. Let me step out of myself, out of just what I might want in the abstract, and ask, what would this dog like to become? How could this dog, yeah, we're talking about you, be excellent?
She looks away.
Can't blame her, right? Can't blame her. And likewise with persons, perhaps. Likewise with inanimate things.
I'm just thinking of parenting.
Yeah, good. Oh, yeah. Good.
You don't get the kid you wanted.
Not ever. Right. Not once.
And how do we help them be excellent?
Sorry, Amber. I guess the term I'd like to leave us here, that maybe the uniqueness is picking up a piece of, that risk in workmanship is a piece of, that this kind of planning execution thing is getting at a piece of, is the idea of responsiveness, of responding to a thing that in some sense already is what it is, already has the potentials that it has or not. And to think about excellence in terms of not something disconnected from any context in some abstract theoretical space, but particular excellences of particular things in Borgman's sense that already have natures or desires or qualities or teloi, the plural of telos, or ends of their own, natures of their own, responsiveness, right? So I would like to suggest responsiveness as a word that picks up on a lot of what we've discussed sitting here in this beautiful little spot right now. So I will invite you, if you're so inclined, as we kind of get up and move. I'm going to move slowly because my leg fell asleep. But to think about that responsiveness and what hook that might give us toward responsibility. Those words sound initially a lot alike. They may or may not ever get used together. I think there might be some threads we can pull out through that as we make our way to the second stop. And so if you want to start kind of thinking over the responsiveness that we've had here and what that might mean for be a responsibility that might be reflected in a kind of excellence. If that doesn't make sense yet, we'll sort it out at the next stop.